This episode of East Meets West is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchased at emw.ting.com. Welcome to East Meets West, episode 301. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
301. We're over the hill, Roger. It's over the hill.
I am over
podcasts.
The hill. I'm officially over the hill tomorrow.
Oh, really? You turn 40 tomorrow?
No. I'm 30.
What?
38.
That's not over the hill.
It's not over the hill for me.
That's near. I mean, you could see the top of the hill.
My body's failing me. I got bitten. I believe I was bit because I still don't know what's going on.
By a zombie, right?
It could be a zombie spider, but it's a very small bite. Perfectly fine. Thursday, I wake up Friday morning. My left heel, when I climb out of bed and I put weight on, it's like, ow! I can't, and I'm limping around.
I can't feel my foot.
Oh, I can feel it. That's why I'm saying ow. And I'm limping around Friday, and then Saturday I was supposed to go to Shannon's birthday party, mm-hmm. and I go to that, and we go to the movie first.
Yeah, I missed you there.
Didn't want to see Twilight because, frankly, not my kind of movie.
Great battle scene.
From what I understand, it's pretty awesome if you like the werewolf vampire conflict.
Even if you just like decapitations.
But I went for the more family friendly Skyfall.
Ha! Yes, also a fantastic movie, a very good movie.
It was a very good movie. I thought it was maybe.
Say also,
I thought it was about 45 minutes too long.
Really? I didn't think so.
I felt there was just a lot of unnecessary fight chase scenes that seemed to were.
So you hadn't seen a Bond movie before?
No, I have.
They're all like that,
and I all think they should be trimmed.
All right, fine.
Although I liked Casino Royale, I think it had great pacing the entire way through. Everything after that was. So you know. Bought crutches at Walgreens and went to see a doctor Monday night after work. And she wasn't really sure what it was either, but...
Wait, you bought crutches for a spider bite? That's serious.
Well, I can't walk on my left... I can't put weight on my left foot.
Wow. Just because of pain?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, imagine if you had a rail spike through your feet. That's pretty much what it feels like when I put weight on it.
Ugh.
So... Yeah, and you know, and she looked at it, and she wasn't really sure. She was feeling around for the ligaments and making sure they're all attached.
Yeah, make sure you didn't rip something.
But it's so localized and it's so particular to the way my foot flexes that, you know, what I said to her, what I thought was perhaps it was an insect bite and the swelling is just basically pushing against the ligament. And since it's right on the heel, there's not a lot of extra fat.
And she said, Mr. Chang, I'll do the doctoring, okay? I think it's swelling pushing on a ligament.
She said, you know, she said it could be and might be probably infected with some sort of, you know,
okay.
bacterial infection. So I went away with a bottle of antibiotics.
Oh, great. Going to make a super bug.
Well, it's one of the tamer varieties of antibiotics. So super bugs have already built immunity to this.
Yeah.
And then the primary care physician called me today and told me to schedule a follow-up appointment with him, or rather his front desk secretary said that, even though I've never been to this doctor yet, because when Discovery bought us, our medical and dental coverage and all that changed. Mm-hmm. So,
but you actually had to change doctors? Or
it's before we had Blue Shield, Blue Cross. I can't remember. Blue something. Now we're on under Aetna.
That's horrible. I would hate that. I would hate to change my doctor just because insurance changed.
Well,
I've had insurance change a lot. And CBS bought Cigna. We had to change all of our insurance too. But I kept my doctor.
I tried to get your doctor, but she wasn't accepting any new patients because
she's pretty busy.
The old doctor had it back at Tech TV was just like, you know, it's like a 3 month, you know, waiting list.
Yeah.
You know, for just a regular appointment. So it's like, screw it. I'll use this opportunity to get a new doctor, and got a new doctor.
doctor.
So hopefully it clears up eventually. The ibuprofen does help with the swelling. So hopefully at some point.
It's an anti-inflammatory, so that, I guess that makes sense.
Yes, that's what she said.
Hey, that's what she said.
Well, I found it very interesting that she ended all her sentences with "hun."
Did she really? Your doctor?
Even though she from the looks of her, she was blonde, blonde, but definitely like younger than me. And it's always weird when I'm generally fine with that if someone's older than me because it's kind of this.
Right.
But when it's younger, it's like it's kind of weird.
Ah, Roger, you're getting old enough to be like
awkward.
Hey, this person's just out of diapers. How are they a doctor?
Where'd you go? Some sort of medical junior high?
I was pulling my weight on a 40-hour work week when you were just a gleam in your father's eye.
I don't think I've ever worked a 40-hour work week. I've
really?
During college.
You lazy bastard.
I actually.
Oh, you mean you never worked as little as 40? Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah. Actually, when I worked at the Olive Garden, they only gave me 20 hours. But when I worked at the pier, I was working 50 plus because I was the only employee for like 3 months. So I had to open and close the store every
day. Did you
get
time and a half, or were you salaried, an exempt employee?
I don't know. I might have gotten time and a half. I don't think I got a lot.
Yeah.
I literally ran the place for 3 months. It was a pain in the ass.
I got.
Let's just say
the
compensation really wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
For the amount of crap I had to
deal with. We got overtime at the bookstore, and they didn't have to. It was Texas. They could have not done it, but they did have standing instructions to managers not to allow overtime unless absolutely necessary.
Generally, yeah. I mean, that's the case for most places I've worked at. Worst, you know, your job is going to entail more than like 40 hours. You're generally like 50 or 60 hours a week. It's like your salary. It's here are your minor benefits, your salary. Woohoo! Now go work.
Yeah.
So
salaried employee,
salad employee.
Mm. Yeah, I was listening to the Economist podcast today, and they were mentioning the hostess.
Going out of
business, and
I should have
and how it was essentially a game of chicken between the company and the unions got to the point. Well, actually, that's right. The Teamsters had a contract. It was the other union. And it got to the point where hostess pulled the trigger, and lo and behold, there was a bullet in the chamber, and so that was that. And they pointed out that unions have been declining in the United States for many different reasons, but a lot of reasons being the fact that many new industries have avoided the organization of unions by making a lot of employees salary. That wasn't their main point. Their main point, they said, is that a lot of unions have forced companies to be less competitive in the marketplace, and thus non-union shops get ahead and become more successful, which I think is also true. But it is interesting how those non-union shops, in a lot of cases, are the ones saying, like, all our employees are exempt.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because, for example, one of the most well-known unions, at least in the U.S., is the United Auto Workers for the big three, Chrysler, Ford, and GM. But what people don't realize is that all the other car, like Toyota, Honda, other foreign manufacturers that build cars, don't work under a union system, but generally give the same wages as a union shop. The only thing that they don't give you is that really generous pension plan that unions manage
well,
to.
Well, and that is an overhead cost that does weigh down on a company.
That's a legacy cost.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the reasons why they've managed to keep, you know, unions out of those shops is they pay relatively well, you know, for the jobs that are had. And the benefits are good enough that, you know, you don't get people that are, you don't get enough people to sign up for a union to actually have a union in those places. So, you know, it's kind of weird. You know, I'm neither pro nor against unions. I just think they are a fact of, you know, the working environment and, you know, the way things.
I am 100% in favor of the right of employees to collectively bargain.
Oh, so am I.
I'm not against that. When people talk about unions and they say unions should go away, I think they sound ignorant to me. Like, really? We shouldn't have the freedom as individuals to join together for our common good? That's just a fundamental right. And then you will get some people like, no, that's not what I mean. It's not about collectively bargaining. It's the unions and their system that requires you to pay dues, even if you didn't vote for the union, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those arguments become more nuanced. But I feel like what happened, the unions have gotten out of hand. This was my grandpa's point of view on it. And he was a big supporter of the unions in the 20s. And then he felt like they got out of hand and they got too powerful and they got greedy. And I think in some cases that is evidently true, not in all cases. I think overall unions have been a net positive for a lot of the reasons that you point out there is that they have driven companies to treat employees better even when there aren't unions present. However, because companies have resisted unionizing so harshly, especially in the 20s, in the early formation of the union, the unions built up kind of harsh reactions. And I think that's what we saw play out is kind of the old style union reaction with Hostess. They said, you say that you're going to go bankrupt if we don't give you these concessions, but these concessions are not the thing that's making you bankrupt. What's making you bankrupt is bad marketing, bad planning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So why should we give in on that? And I think some of that may have been true, but that was always the case when you basically tried to union bust. You didn't union negotiate back in the day. And that created a culture for unions to try to grab as much as they could get. And then when they got popular and when they got successful, powerful men moved in and took them over for their own benefit in some cases.
But, you know, and that's really, I think, what underscores a lot of, you know, the issues with, you know, either unions with entitlements and companies with executives who have a overly entitled mentality to their golden parachutes and all that, is that, you know, when you're dealing with something very lucrative, you tend to attract a lot of people who might not have anyone's best interests at heart relative to their own. So it could be union management, it could be the company's management, it could be any combination thereof. And what I've noticed is there's really no silver bullet. There's no one answer that fits all companies. Like, you know, a no union shop here is good, and that it's going to be good for everyone else. Or a union at this company makes it good for everyone, but it doesn't mean unions across the board for every company is going to be good. You know, you have situations where you have like United Airlines, which is ostensibly an employee-owned company, and that, you know, they're just, you know, treading water at this point in the marketplace. And, you know, it's just really comes – it really comes down to good business management and, you know, a very competitive product or service that you're offering compared to other, you know, to other offerings in the same market. So, I mean, you know, what I'm getting at is there is no one answer. There's no one shoe that fits all situations.
I want to pick this up, but we should thank our sponsor for the show, as we mentioned at the beginning, Ting.com. Giving you savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. You can try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase if you go to emw.ting.com. If you haven't heard us talking about Ting before, they're the folks that do hover.com. They're the folks from Two Cows. Their focus is on the user. And in fact, this kind of ties in with what I want to talk about with unions, is what the measurement of success for a company should be. For the folks at Two Cows who operate Ting, their measurement of success is, are the users happy? Are the people who use our service getting what they need? And so they focus not on tricking you into spending a lot of money, which seems to be what a lot of mobile carriers do, but on billing clarity, usability, and allowing you to estimate your costs accurately so you save money. It's a simple plan. Basically, you pay megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately, and each one of those has a tier where you can, you know, you get a certain amount of data, a certain amount of calls, certain amount of text messages. If you use more than your tier, you don't get a punitive rate because you didn't guess right. You actually just move up to the next tier. They say, oh, well, you were at the $10 tier and you used the amount that goes in the $15 tier. We'll just pay $15. We're not going to punish you for not anticipating what was going to happen in your life, for not being a seer who could see the future. And likewise, you may say, well, that's all great, but what happens if I use less, huh? If I overestimated, what happens? Well, you pay less. you're credited the difference at the end of the month. There's no premiums. There's no penalties. You just pay for what you use. And they offer good phones. They have the Samsung Galaxy S3. Granted, you do have to pay for the phone, but you're not tied into a contract. So go check them out. Go to emw.ting.com. Do a little estimation. Look at the products you have available. You'll be impressed by the kinds of phones these guys have. And then figure out, okay, so if I have to pay a little bit up front for the phone, how much am I going to save over the course of a year or so? You'll see the difference. emw.ting.com. Big thanks to them for supporting East Meets West. So even if you're slightly interested, give them some thanks for supporting us by going to emw.ting.com. Now, Roger, when we were talking about the unions, we were talking about the interplay between them. It made me think about the measurements of success. That was another thing I heard on the same Economist podcast. Different story. The idea that we shouldn't look at stock price or share price as the measure of success anymore. And a lot of folks are bandying about new ways. Some of them are. Is the customer satisfied? Of course, the risk there is, well, the customer would be satisfied if you gave them everything for free. So there's a danger to hooking it just on customer satisfaction. Some people say, well, it should be stakeholder value, not shareholder value. But then you get in the same kind of problems you have with shareholder value, where you're over-concentrating on stakeholder value. The commentator that I was listening to suggested, you know, it should actually be a combination of multiple parts of this, that shareholder value should contribute to the goal of a company. But his suggestion was, if you are a manager, you should not be allowed to benefit from stock decrease or increase while you are working at the company. And he pointed out that, you know, some managers benefit by making sure that the company is run poorly before they take over, maybe they're a junior manager jockeying for a position, or maybe they're coming in from the outside and they're just talking down the company. And that if they're only going to be there for 2 or 3 years, as seems to be the case in a lot of CEO situations, that they may be willing to obfuscate, cheat, push, spin the numbers up, do short-term things to make the numbers, you know, juke the stats before they exit to drive that share price up so that they can sell it while they're working there. And his suggestion is allow an employee to vest stock, but only sell it after a certain period of time has passed post-retirement. What do you think of that?
It's the way companies generate profit. I mean, either through shareholder value, through dividends, through just actual, like, you know, how much money they made, you know, versus, you know, subtracting from, you know, overhead and all the other costs. It's kind of weird because there are so many different various, you know, calculations you need to make. And I think that does make sense to use kind of a basket of different weighted measurements as a whole in order to kind of get an aggregate understanding of how well a company is doing. Because a company could be awesome, like on the stocks, but if it's barely etching out a profit or no profit at all, but on the expectation that because this company might do well in the future or whatever, that and so their stock prices go up, it could give a false sense of how the company actually, you know, well it's doing. I mean, Zynga's sort of at that point right now, I think. I think it does make sense. I mean, a lot of the ways we do things were kind of developed 30, 40, 50 years ago, and it stands to reason as, you know, the economy diversifies and sources of income diversifies, you do want to kind of build a new system or at least modify the existing one to take those into account.
Yeah, I think what I was thinking as I was listening to this discussion was that this is a fine idea, and I have long complained that concentrating on shareholder value as the be-all, end-all of a company overdoes it and does, to the detriment of society, encourage short-term outlooks. You see very few companies who actually buck that trend, but they do exist. Apple, for instance, especially under Steve Jobs, and it's been seeming to be the same under Tim Cook, doesn't care about their earnings report. They do an earnings report, but they're willing to underestimate analyst expectations. They don't care about their stock price, and it seems to have worked out for them. They're in it for the long haul, and it seems to be a way to success, or at least it has been for the past decade for them. Unilever only does earnings reports every 6 months because they're trying to discourage the idea that you need to look quarter by quarter at all the fluctuations. They say, no, you know, we want to take a longer term view. I think society as a whole has to grapple with what it is that we should value. In Western society, it tends to be money. Are we making enough money? We look at the health of a nation based on gross domestic product, based on the economy. And I think that's the same problem. You're only looking at one measurement, and it's an important measurement.
Yeah.
But what about sustainability? What about happiness? Granted, the economy and making money are both major factors in determining those things. But to me, it's like making a lot of money is not the thing that makes people happy. In fact, you can have all kinds of semantic arguments about whether making money makes you happier or not happier. But what is important in life is feeling like you're making progress. Some people say, oh, it's not important to be happy. It's just important to be occupied. Whatever. Self-satisfaction with your life should be the aim of society. Yeah. And making money and having a good economy should only be valued up to the point that it helps that. And those are one and the same, but I don't think they are.
Well, they are and they aren't. I mean, one of my personal pet peeves is that you can have, you know, profits don't matter, the economy doesn't matter. In any calculation, it does matter because that's kind of what underpins everything else. And it's not to say that you're wrong, that there's more to life than you know, aggregating wealth and, you know, material things. And I totally believe that's true. But at the same time, you know, I think it's very easy to kind of downplay the importance of what the economy means for a lot of people, because, you know, if a healthy economy means that most people, or ideally a majority of the population that is of working age, is employed and is earning a living, because that enables them to do things like, you know, pay for higher education, and at least in the U.S., pay for healthcare, food, healthy foods, you know, being able to take a vacation that allows you to decompress from, the stresses of work. So, I mean, it's really hard to say, like, how a society – I mean, we could totally, you know, regress into a less – you know, developed nation and still, you know, be happy. I mean, was one of the things that Time or Newsweek did like 10 years ago, like who the happiest people in the U.S. were. And I think at the top were the Amish. And then anyone know the Amish, they're not exactly rolling in dough. You know, they're not.
Well, unless it's literally flour and water.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, for what they've earned, it's a modest sum compared to, you know, most upper or most middle class Americans, but it's enough to keep their family happy and all of them happy. And if that suits them, that's great. And that totally goes to your point that we should look beyond. But at the same time, without, you know, having the crops to come in and the things to sell and people buying it, things might not be as rosy with the family. If, you know, there's stress on, you know, there's not going to be enough food to eat, how are we going to pay for new clothes, new roof, and all that other stuff that goes with, you know, living.
Yeah, but you're doing the same thing that I find frustrating when I hear any of this discussed, which is if you suggest that money maybe isn't the only factor, then the argument is, yeah, but you can't throw money out. And that's not what I'm suggesting at all. I agree with everything you said. Money is important in all of the ways that you said. But the problem isn't that you said it's too easy to discount money. Nobody discounts money. I don't know where that myth comes from. But nobody is out there saying money isn't important, right? I mean, sure, self-help people are out there saying if you want to live a happy life, money isn't important. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying in the serious policy discussions about how we should form policy that guides and governs our societies, no one's suggesting let's just ignore the economy. What I'm suggesting is that it's the opposite. To the exclusion of everything else, we tend to focus on the economy. And when the economy goes bad, we tend to overreact and overdramatize the dangers. And that it's, I feel almost like I'm going to be branded a heretic or insensitive for saying that. Because I'm not saying that when the economy goes bad, that means everybody's happy. To have a reasonable discussion, you have to be willing to say, okay, we had a recession and lots of bad things happened, but look around, you know? And I can point to people. You can point to people who are out of a job, who've had a really rough go. My brother's had a horrible time during this recession. Most of the people I know haven't had a horrible time. Most of the people I know have been able to get by just fine. Maybe they've had to cut back. Maybe they've had to reduce that vacation plan. But most of the people are doing okay. And so I think we just tend to catastrophize the effects of money. And I'm not calling for us to ignore it or say that it has no effect. I'm saying, well, let's look at what else makes a satisfactory society. In addition to that, let's keep it as maybe even the most important thing, but not to the exclusion of all else. And that seems to be what we do now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we're arguing the same kind of point from opposite sides.
Yeah, I think so too.
So, but it's interesting because, you know, especially people who are, I guess the best term would be a vulnerable job. Jobs that tend to come and go with recessions and stuff tend to be a lot more concerned about things like that. Just you know, being around a lot of my dad's employees who have relatives or whatever, and you know, you always hear their stories. I grew up with kind of a perhaps maybe an overly sensitive view of things like that, because I would always have stories every day of someone's brother, someone's mother, someone's family member, you know, going through, or even the employee themselves going through a very rough patch because, you know, they need more hours. Their husband lost a job because, you know, a plant cut back on the number of shifts.
But how many of those people became homeless and started starving? And how many of those people maybe went through a rough patch and then found their way, you know, to a sustainable life?
They weren't homeless, but there were more than a handful of people who lost their homes and had to move in with family, mm-hmm. like with their family.
Sure.
So
sure. And I'm not saying that that's good or that's optimal.
But it is a stress. It is a point of stress for people.
It's bad stress. Yeah.
So
it's, you know, you're right. We're arguing it from different ends, but I think the end that you're coming from seems to be the only end people want to pay attention to. And I'm saying let's add into this debate. You know, what is it about the way we've structured society that allows those people to have such a hard time transitioning from job to job? Is there a better way to set things up? Is there something we can do that values sustainability so that we don't have so many ups and downs and troughs. The problem that those people experienced wasn't economic. Economic problems are problems that apply on a macro scale. There are problems that were microeconomic, I guess, but their problems were they had to move back in with someone else. They had to reduce the optimal living situation. They had to go without some things that they would like to go with.
I mean,
and
also,
they may not have been able to eat the proper nutrition that they should. And to me, I'm like, okay, those are the things we need to focus on. So how do we make sure that people have a good living situation, get enough to eat, have shelter, and feel satisfied with their life? And people say, well, Tom, shut up. You give them a job. Maybe that's one way, or maybe the job allows them to buy a house and move out, but takes away all of their free time and makes them miserable. In other words, I'm saying it's not just that simple.
No, I agree. And ironically enough, I think you're oversimplifying. I think it's not that, and I finally kind of keyed on this a few years ago. It's not direct. I mean, it is the economy, but it's indirectly so, because what this really all, and this kind of boils down to is security. People feeling secure enough to say that, okay, and it's not even just my existing living standard, but being able to live without having to worry about all these things. I think one of the things that underpins, at least in a person's, you know, mind about what security is not having to worry about things on that scale. Yeah, there's things about like, oh, you know, we're going to have to pay, get this, car fixed, about 3 months after everything else falls upon it. But like when you're worrying about week to week, month to month, like, hey, am I going to be in the same place? You know, am I going to have to pull my kids out of school because, you know, I can no longer afford to live here and we'll have to move, you know, to my folks who live in another state. I mean, there's all these other things. And I think part of it is a lot of what we deem security, you know, our ability to aggregate material things and money was always kind of seen as kind of the security blanket. You know, as long as you have a job, no matter what happens to you, you'll find a way out of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think you know that correlation between economic well-being and personal security are so intertwined with people that it's really hard to pull those
Well, and the reason I want to pull them apart is the way it tends to go, it seems, is to say, well, if you want security, you're talking socialism. And socialism just brings everybody down and makes everybody poor. And that's not good. And I'm not suggesting socialism by suggesting that you need to be secure, and neither is Roger. I think what you want to say is oh, well, maximizing shareholder value is the way to increase the security of that person who lost their job. And it's not. And that's where I'm going. Not that, oh, and therefore the government should come in and pay that person and give them food. I'm not saying that either. I'm saying that a system that maximizes shareholder value does not actually provide security for the majority of people. And so we do need a better spin on the free market system, possibly minimal government interference at some point. I'm not a free market maximalist, because I think an entirely free market is just as much of a pipe dream and ideal as communism was. But I do think that more free market usually works better, and especially when it's fine tuned. But that market needs to be pushing towards the right goal. And if the goal is maximizing shareholder value, you tend to have a lot of inefficiencies. You tend to have companies that don't serve the customer. You tend to have companies that view short-term success over long-term goals, and they're not sustainable. And you tend to have companies that benefit the so-called 1%. And so my guess is a free market economy is the right way to go. We just need a different goal for the companies to focus on. And that's why I was so interested in that podcast.
Well, it's interesting because, things like shareholder value and stuff are relatively recent. I don't think it was a big thing back in the 60s or even the 70s. I mean,
it was
manifests,
the 80s and 90s where it really became the buzzword, so to speak.
The decades of Wall Street, having that huge linchpin in the American psyche. And I think part of it is just, people, communities, and it's just not one individual. It has to be a group of people opting in or out of that system. Hey, we want to be a modest community. We know we don't have a 24-hour swimming pool with, heated pool with all sorts of amazing things, but, we have enough to get by. We don't have the latest and greatest, library facilities, but we have a working library that is adequate to meet the needs of the population. And I think California in some ways is kind of a poster child of this. It's when California was going to the dot-com boom, it wasn't really doing all that well in terms of the amount of debt that the state was carrying. But with the dot-com boom, it's like, hey, we got a new source of cash, and everyone kind of got a little high on the kind of this new wealth. And people, the Atlantic Monthly actually had a great article. Everyone just kind of got into the we can spend money like there's no tomorrow. And so they were giving out generous pension packages for public employees. Cities were spending on all these things. And the problem was that, you know, like all, you know, economic boom and bust cycles, you have a great beginning, but you also have a very bad end. And, you know, the follow up with the real estate bust just kind of was kind of the kick in the groin that kind of put the state to its knees. And, you know, just having, I think in some ways, just having a more realistic outlook, you know, having like, okay, let's just assume that all we'll be taking in is this X amount of dollars. How do we spend? I think part of the problem is that, you know, as soon as people see, you know, their income spike up, they suddenly assume they're richer and they spend that way. And where I was raised, at least the way I was, you know, raised, you kind of have to assume that that spike that you get from that increased income won't be there forever. Now, you got to understand, you know, you got to pace yourself, I guess is a good word for it. Like, you have to pace the way you spend, because you can't always assume that you're making the same amount of dollars you are now. Does it make sense, or is that a little?
No, I have the exact same philosophy. I think most people have that philosophy, Roger. I think it's a false image that has been planted in our head that people don't live that way. People do live that way. There's also lots of people who don't live that way, and there's just lots of people. So I don't think it's uncommon at all for people to do that.
I think it's more common than people think because it's hidden. I think it's hidden because a lot of people assume they need to own property.
Well, I think when you're saying it's hidden,
I mean, the
people who are spending sensibly, you don't notice them.
Well, no,
because they're spending sensibly.
I understand.
You notice the people who go bankrupt. You notice the people whose cars get repossessed. You notice the people who are spending like crazy and like, wow, where'd you get the money for that? You don't notice the person who is living within their means.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that their entire lives could be very reasonable, very practical, you know, to the cars they drive, to the entertainment they choose, to the types of food when they go out and all that. But the biggest kick for a lot of people, and you know, the whole underwater mortgages deal is the fact that a lot of people purchased these homes on the assumption that home values always increase, and so they were willing to get themselves mortgaged.
Yeah, but most people's homes aren't underwater.
Well, not. And well, that's
there
true.
There are many homes that are underwater. Mine is one of them. But most people's homes are not underwater.
Well, in California, I would say yes. That would actually not be true.
You'd say most people's homes are underwater in California.
Their values have dropped. For what they for
most people's homes value. Almost all people's homes values have declined. I'm not saying that. I'm saying actually underwater.
Do you know under? Yeah, you mean people who are paying more than
people who owe more than their home is worth.
I thought it was pretty high.
It's high, but it's not most. Sure. And I say that because the banks are out there offering to refinance homes like crazy, and they will not refinance you if your home is worth less than you paid for it, unless your mortgage is through a government program.
22% of all homes with mortgages are considered underwater.
There you go. That's a lot. I'm not saying
it
isn't, but it's also not most.
That's about 11 million.
That means 78% of people's homes are not underwater.
Ah, this actually leads into the whole, you know, but that's still a big chunk of the economy, and that does have. I don't know, trickle.
Yeah, my only point was that we tend to want to overestimate the visible statistics. So I'm not arguing that 22% is an outlandish figure and it's wrong and it is an indication of a big problem in the economy. But we had moved on to talking about people's fiscal habits and I don't think most people have bad fiscal habits, but I think there are too many people who do have bad fiscal habits.
All right. So you're in agreement then?
Yeah. Again, we're just disagreeing from other sides
different
of an
angles.
Agreement.
We'll
wrap actually, it up. Go ahead.
I was just going to bring this up. What if actually there is no happy equilibrium? What if life is really just to be one giant roller coaster of emotion, of like happy, joyful, and then deep depression as things go bad.
Well, you're presupposing in your question that life is one particular thing.
Exactly.
I don't know.
Maybe life should be hard.
Maybe life is most satisfying when it's hard. And if we were to determine that, then maybe we should make life hard.
We should make life hard for you and see how you do.
I sort of think that your life is more satisfactory when you have challenges. Not necessarily hard.
Hardships.
I don't think you should suffer. I don't think that makes sense. But yeah, I think if life is too easy, it's not as satisfying.
Hardship. Yeah. Hardship.
But not
I just like
a
that
sinking word. Ship. There's a difference.
Hardship. It always sounds like something really bad in a book. Hardship. Hardship. It's like a ship made out of concrete or something.
Hardship. A ship made out of concrete. How will it float? Find out on the next East Meets West. Well, thank you. Have a happy Thanksgiving, Roger.
You too. I hope your Thanksgiving goes off well, as I hope mine does too.
Yes, same here. And for those of you out there who do not celebrate the United States holiday of Thanksgiving, have a happy...
Sucks to be you.
Ashura, or perhaps a Muharram, or...
Or for Canadians, it was last month.
Yeah, or a penumbral lunar eclipse, whatever. The International Day of the Elimination of Violence Against Women is November 25th. Maybe that's what we'll celebrate. Whatever it is, have a good one.
Bye.
Is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.